This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Vossman. Vossman. 18110. September. 03355. Motion. 10023. 74095. Suddenly brighter. Spectra desirable.
That was code. And you're quite right. This is a spy story. This is about men who want to get hold of the secret plans of the supernova. This is about the riddle of the White Dwarf. You interested? The Columbia Workshop, radio's leading experimental theater, presents program number 21 of 26 by Corwin. An astronomical half hour entitled Good Heavens, written and produced by Norman Corwin, with an original musical score composed and conducted by Lynn Murray. And dedicated to the Yerkes Observatory of the University of Chicago in commemoration of the 50th anniversary celebration of that institution.
Listener, are you willing to take a chance on having a few set notions blasted? Would you like to meet up with some of your own first-class misconceptions? All right, then, listen. And don't say we didn't warn you.
This is a script about astronomy. That code you heard a minute back is no mere gag. It's the actual wording of a telegram sent out last week by the head astronomer of Harvard to all observatories in America. What it means, we'll tell you later. First, however, we must clear up for you the matter of what kind of life goes on at astronomical observatories. Now, there are many misconceptions about what serious astronomers do with their time. Thanks to interstellar comic strips, here's what many people think is likely to be overheard on clear nights under the mysterious domes where super telescopes are housed.
All right, Billingsgate, you've been looking long enough. Now give me a crack.
Wait a minute, Hotchkiss. I think I see something moving.
You do? Oh, I say, Dr. Dumkey, Billingsgate has detected life on Mars.
Now, just a moment, Hotchkiss. I didn't say that at all. I merely said I thought I saw something moving.
Well, let me see.
Here you are, Hotchkiss.
Thanks. Increase the magnification, 2 magnitudes. Enough.
See.
Nothing. Billingsgate, you were seeing things.
Oh, I resent that, Professor. I was only...
Good evening, gentlemen. Nothing new. We're still searching.
Ah, very good. Now, keep your eye glued to Mars. And while you're at it, be on the lookout for exploding stars and new comets. We want to be the first to see them if there are any around.
All right, sir.
Also, check a couple of constellations for weather predictions before it gets light.
Yes, sir.
I'm going back to the laboratory to continue work on the rocket ship. But in the meantime, Dumkey, would you give Jupiter and Venus a once-over, just in case there might be signs of life on them? Never can tell where something might show up.
Righto, Dr. Abington. All right. Swinger 6 degrees to the west.
Swinger 6 degrees to the west.
Yeah, what do you see?
Well, just a minute. Give me a chance.
Let me see. Let me
get out of the way.
No, that's not what goes on in an observatory of a clear night. Astronomers don't keep their eyes glued to their telescopes. They spend very little time gazing at the fancy showpieces of the sky. Hardly ever look at the rings of Saturn or the craters of the moon. And they're not at all concerned with watching the planet Mars for signals to be flashed to Earth. And nor do they ever make weather predictions or have a desire to travel through space in rocket ships.
Want to know what really is typical of a night at a big observatory like Yerkes? Music, please, for atmosphere.
Dark and uninhabited observatory broods under the northern constellations. Off on the horizon, there's a faint glow of light from some folksy little town in the valley. But here, it is dark and quiet, except for the chirp and chatter of the unseen population of the fields. This man is an astronomer. He's quite alone. He's opening the door of the observatory. Observatories have doors with locks in them, like your house. Now, he enters the dome. A gray vault full of echoes, dark and cold and drafty. It is terrible and solemn. Like an inquisition chamber of a comic strip of characters who conveniently commute between the stars. A little light goes on now. Enough to make out the great hulk of a gigantic telescope mounted on a massive pier. Bigger girthed and longer than the fiercest cannon. Now he pulls a cord which moves a shutter in the dome. And now the roof is a slit, the heavens shining through. This done, he walks to a control board, and he pulls a lever. And the floor rises. The floor has risen up beneath his feet, risen three times his height. And now he pulls another lever, and the great refractor swings around to meet the open sector of the dome. This telescope weighs 20 tons, and yet it can be moved by hand. Our friend now reaches up and pulls it down to bring its eyepiece closer to his eye. Then, having found his field...
Right ascension, 3 hours, 55 minutes. Declination, minus 13 degrees, 41 seconds.
He trains it on the star 40 Eridani. 40 for its order in the ascension, Eridani for the constellation in which it appears. And now he's twiddling screws to move cross wires. Reading a micrometer to keep the great glass steady on its objective. Meanwhile, a silence mechanism keeps the telescope turning westward... exactly at the rate of the Earth's rotation eastward. In this way, the poised and balanced giant follows automatically the pinpoint in the sky which the astronomer has singled out. Now, for just a moment, the image of the star is studied. It burns like some forgotten signal lantern at a junction of two skies. The naked eye is closed now, and it senses something of the unimaginable force that throbs so many, many billions of kilometers away. It gathers in the long, pulsating rays. It feels the grave and mystic splendor of this numbered sphere, whose light for more than 60 years has been traveling through space to keep this rendezvous. He's noted all he needs to note. And now, he disengages the eyepiece and substitutes for it a camera plate holder. He's going to take a photograph, which may be studied later under microscopes. Exposure? Say 10 seconds for dramatic license. It might well be closer to an hour. He sets an astronomical alarm clock to the length of the exposure. We'll leave the doctor now while he takes his plate and goes inside a portable dark room to develop the film. When he comes out, he'll enter in a data book a log of observations concerning 40 Eridani. He will go home at 2 a.m. Another member of the observatory staff will come in at 2 and use the telescope till dawn. And when the dawn comes...
A little dawn music, Mr. Murray, please.
Practical-minded listeners want to know what good there is in all this. After the stars have been charted, weighed, their distances determined, their elements found out, so what do you want to know? Well, in the first place, since when does the pursuit of a pure science have to apologize to practical men?
I say, Mr. Pennypacker, do you mind if I pursue my study of spectroheliography? I know it may take me a lifetime, and it may yield no commercially important results, but...
What does
Pennypacker,
Pennypacker know about the possible practical results of spectroheliography? Pennypacker's busy packing pennies. Let him stick to it. Even if astronomy never meant a hoot toward the improvement of human existence, that would be no reason why its work should not persist, or why it should require any statement of defense. But consider now some of astronomy's more practical applications. Everyday ones.
When you hear the musical note, the time will be exactly 42 minutes and 5 seconds past 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
It will be high tide at Sandy Hook at 2:16 a.m. tomorrow.
Our ship's position is latitude 56 degrees, 9 minutes south, longitude 77 degrees, 4 minutes west.
The government has just ordered 10,000 more tanks of helium for military purposes. And we are filling the orders as quickly as possible.
Time, the special province of astronomy. Tide, the pull of sun and moon upon the earth. Navigation, largely a system of solar and lunar measurements. Helium, an element discovered on the sun before it was discovered in the earth. And listen, Mr. Pennypacker, more.
The sun and stars hold within them the secret of releasing tremendous quantities of energy from matter. We don't yet know the answer to the riddle of the sun's renewal. If we find out, the Earth will never have to worry about fuel. For a single fallen leaf might move a ship around the world.
Matter into energy? Here are some cold statistics which may raise a Pennypacker's hair.
Question. How much of the sun's total energy does the Earth intercept? Do you think you can guess within 20%?
Answer. 1/20,000,000 of 1%.
Question. Within 1,000 degrees, what is the temperature of the sun's interior?
Answer. 10,000,000 degrees centigrade.
Question. By Einstein's formula, the sun is losing 4,000,000 tons of mass each second. At this rate, how soon will it be before it decreases by 0.5%? To see if you can guess within 6 months.
Answer. 75,000,000,000 years.
Hey, isn't it time for your time motif again, Mr. Murray?
About time. Do you know the time of day, Mac?
Do you know what year it is? You think it's 1941? All depends on where you are. Now, if you ask a citizen of Tokyo, he'd say
it's the year 2601.
And note, please, that in our literal translation from the Japanese, our actor does not say
it is the year 2601.
Why do all foreign people in radio drama speak broken English in their own countries? Oh, well. Mohammedan would tell you.
This is the year 1360 of the era of the Hegira.
An Orthodox Jew counts farther back than an Orthodox Gentile.
The new year which commenced last week is, according to our calendar, 5,702.
And an ancient Byzantine returned to Earth today would calculate...
Why, this is the year 7,450.
Whereas an ancient Greek would figure it...
Year 2,717 of the Olympiad sport, or the first year of the 680th Olympiad, also sport.
At two workshops? That's all, brother.
Now then, let's talk about time. That which is so much a part of us, shaping our lives before we're born, that which we have so much of, yet so little. Time can be measured more easily than it can be defined. This thing, so common in our lives, defies description. For example, now, I'll ask at random two actors in the studio. They're not prepared for this. Morgan, how would you define time?
Time is what my watch tells me.
Not so easy. Not so good. Mayhoff, how about a definition from you?
Well, time is an opportunity to do something.
See what I mean? We go around talking very loosely about time, though there's only one kind of it.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good evening.
Good night.
Yesterday.
Tomorrow.
When?
Now.
Early.
Late.
Soon.
Always.
Before.
During.
After.
Never. You'd think by the commonness of these words, the time was absolutely uniform to our senses and to our lives. But of course it's not. To each of us, time's a sensation of a special sort, according to what occupies our consciousness at any given moment.
Oh, my, the way that time's flown by. Seems like it was only yesterday we started on our honeymoon.
Or else this sort of measurement.
You have no idea what a boring time we had. I thought the show would never end. It seemed like 1,000 years to me.
Outside our isolated solar system, time is relative in still another way. It's not what we think it is. No, not even the astronomers assure us. They argue queer theories with such impressive names as...
The relativity of simultaneity.
Time. That's a program by itself some night. Maybe on workshop when the 26 are over. It should have an all-star cast, including...
Greenwich Mean Time.
Nautical Time.
Absolute Time.
Mathematical Time.
Empirical Time.
Psychological Time.
Sidereal Time.
Standard Time.
Solar Time.
Time and a half, three-quarters time.
Time immemorial.
Time out of mind.
Time loan.
Time bomb.
Leisure Time.
Hard Time.
Time at that.
Time magazine.
Any old time.
And, of course, time for the time motif. Now then, is there a doctor of philosophy in the house? Have you a genius in your home? Is there anybody listening who thinks he knows all the answers? If there is, let him take the stand.
I'm not a PhD or a genius, and there may be some answers I don't know. But I've had a fairly decent education.
Good. Would you care to come to the microphone, please? Be seated, sir. Now tell me, do parallel lines ever meet?
No, of course not.
Wrong. They do.
I was taught they don't.
Well, I was taught they do.
By whom?
By Einstein. Question number two. Can a straight line be extended infinitely?
How's that again?
If you draw a perfectly straight line, and if it runs off your paper and out of your window and into space infinitely far, will it keep on going straight forever?
Why, sure.
Wrong. It would finally return to itself.
Why?
Because space is curved.
Now, wait a minute.
Do the sum of the angles of a triangle equal two right angles?
Why, everybody knows that. I was taught that in the fourth grade. I suppose that's wrong, too, is it?
You're right. You're wrong.
Wrong.
Wrong. According to the laws of space and time.
But we're not in space, mister. We're on solid Earth.
Wrong again. Why, every structure in the world, the granite mountain and the shapeless air, the very steel beams of this building are aquiver with the atomic life, that tremble with great systems of submicroscopic motion. And, gentlemen of the jury, what is light and color
What is sound but more vibration?
Look, you keep your atoms and molecules. I still say the earth is solid. Doesn't wiggle under my feet. Doesn't slip around. It turns very smoothly on its axis. And it minds its own business. And it doesn't get carried away by every new theory that comes along.
You don't have to get reactionary about it.
I'm not getting reactionary.
You are so.
Well, what authority have you got for what you're giving out here?
Authority? Ah. Will astronomers Brown, Jones, Smith, and Doe take the stand, please?
Not for nothing that the Columbia Workshop has hired Morgan as prosecuting attorney.
Now, Professor Brown, tell the court, does the earth wiggle under your feet?
Yes, indeed, sir. The crust of the earth apparently slips relative to the terrestrial core. There are on the average of 3,212 earthquakes throughout the globe every year.
Thank you, Dr. Jones. Dr. Jones, does the earth turn very smoothly on its axis?
The axis of the planet does not hold fast, no. It's unsteadiness.
Just one moment, if you please. One moment, Doctor. Just
a second. Oh, yes.
No photographs, please, until the hearing is over. Thank you.
All right, go on, Mr. Jones.
In fact, the crust of the earth slips all the time. It produces complicated vibrations of latitude, which bother us sometimes when we're trying to determine accurate positions of stars.
Thank you.
Oh, well,
thank you a great deal,
Mr.
Doctor. Thank you very much.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith, would you bear that out?
Yes, sir. Moreover, the rotation of the earth is not perfectly even because the sun and moon drag on our equator, giving rise to certain intricate, though minor, motions. And also, the earth itself is changing its form.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Doe, your colleague speaks of the intricate motions of the earth. Can you name offhand the various directions in which our earth is gyrating or drifting?
Why, yes, sir. That's quite simple. There are six. First, there's the daily rotation of the earth, the eastward rotation, night and day.
A speed?
For about 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, 750 miles an hour in the latitude of New York.
Yes. Next?
Second, there's a...
All right, all right. The earth is moving in six directions at once. Okay. Now, can I cross-examine you?
What was that?
Can I cross-examine you?
I don't get the name.
Just change places with me here.
Well, kind of irregular.
Yeah. Those are orbits, wise guy.
Who's a wise guy?
You.
Me?
Yes, you.
Wouldn't like a pop on the nose, would you, quiz kid?
Now, is that a dignified question to ask on a program dedicated to the Earth Observatory?
No, I guess not. They won't think well of me, a Yerkes, will they?
Hardly.
They'll think I'm a Yerk.
Perhaps they will.
I apologize. You may proceed to cross-examine me.
Now, in the biblical book of Job, there is an allusion to the morning stars singing together.
Morning stars singing together?
Yes. Now, since you are full of astronomical lore, perhaps you can tell me what that sounded like.
I can tell you what it didn't sound like.
All right, what didn't it sound like?
Like this.
Ooh, Daddy, how are diamond rings, bracelets, everything? Daddy, you ought to get the best for me, Zada.
I move that be stricken from the record.
All right, strike it.
Very well. Now, Morgan, you have attempted in this hearing to demonstrate at my expense that the average man entertains several misconceptions regarding the laws of time and space.
Yes, precisely so.
Did it ever occur to you that the ordinary man wishes to understand only those forces of nature which he encounters in his daily life?
Well, as a matter of fact, it occurred to me only yesterday while I was shaving.
And that he wishes to understand these only so far as it's necessary for him to keep alive and well?
Well...
Then, let there be no easy assumption that the man in the street is naive. It happens that the astronomer has access to far-reaching sources of information, and so his naivete becomes relative. It's simply ignorance on a much higher plane.
This is degenerating into a bull session, and I'm getting the worst of it.
The astronomer knows things which stagger us, but the things he knows he doesn't know stagger him.
Such as what? Name two.
Such as the white dwarf.
Snow White and the White Dwarf?
No, dwarf stars, which, while smaller than the Earth, have volumes greater than our sun. Their density is so great and their gravity so strong that a cigarette on their surface would weigh about 200,000 tons.
What makes White Dwarf, Daddy?
Astronomers don't know.
What else don't they know?
They don't know the limits of the universe. They don't know why some stars flare up suddenly and die down again. They don't know what will happen when galaxies, which are now rushing away from us at a rate of 40,000 miles a second, accelerate their speed until they reach the speed of light, which is the greatest known speed. They don't know about the disintegration of matter. They don't know what happens to all the energy that has been radiated into space. They don't know whether...
He's speaking now of mysteries no earthbound Sherlock Holmes, no Moto, no crafty Fu Manchu can help to solve. These are the spiraled questions, the enigmas hung up in the purple sky. They gaze down on the tortured face of our most pitiable planet. Gaze down on us with the patience of long and loping universe. These are the mysteries which our distant children, in their clean and honorable and benign societies, will still attempt to fathom, looking through the brighter glasses of a happier millennium. These are the passions of the good and goodly heavens, the fierce and holy matters of remotenesses beyond the farthest tendrils of the outstretched mind. And nebula, of cluster and of constellation, men who silently, alone, patrol the shores of night, who track sidereal wanderers down, and weigh and measure them, and take their temperatures. You men who've traveled farther standing still than 20 million Marco Polos, tell us, are we not brave and meaning animals? Do we not make a kind of plaintive music of our intermission here? Do we not clock war's baleful equinoxes by the rhythmic dripping of our blood? Are we not hopeful seekers after the nebulae of truth and patient watchers for the ray of hope? Tell us, astronomers of all the world's observatories, what is the magnitude of man?
You have been listening to the Columbia Workshops presentation of Good Heavens, written and directed by Norman Corwin as program number 21 in the current series, 26 by Corwin, with an original musical score composed and conducted by Lynn Murray. Henry Morgan, better known to radio as Here's Morgan, played the part of the prosecuting attorney, and Martin Wilson did the cross-examining. Narration was shared by Bartlett Robinson, Louis Van Ruten, and Morgan. Others in the cast were Eddie Mayhoff, Ann Boley, Norman Ober, Bill Watts, Kenneth Delmar, and John Brewster. Next Sunday, the Columbia Workshop will be broadcast to the West Coast at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and to the East Coast at the usual time of 10:30. Consult your local papers for the time in your vicinity. The program will be number 22 of 26 by Corwin. The workshop wishes to thank all those who wrote to request a repeat of their favorite program in the 26 by Corwin series. The voting has been close, with the Odyssey of Runyon Jones slightly ahead of the rest. The final choice will be announced next Sunday, and the play selected by listeners will be given its encore performance as number 25 of the series on October 26th. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.